Well, you do what you have to do, that's all. Duty calls, you answer the drum.
We've doubled up about three groups. European Broadcast Union, All Eurovision, which is the rest of the world television, VOA, me, and NASA headquarters, Radio TV, is also shooting some film. Mm-hmm. Hey, do you guys prefer that it be under the tie? I think we get a little crisper sound with it on top, don't you? Do you guys mind if we have it on top? Just because it makes less noise. Sandy, will you put it on top of the tie? We don't mind it showing because we get a clearer audio that way.
Now on your tie, Brett.
Yeah, we notice this on the others.
The tie switches now.
I know. By my time, we're 19 minutes after the hour, John, right?
My time,
20. Huh?
My time,
20. By your time, it's 20 past the hour?
That's not hooked on.
Okay.
Okay.
Buzz, thank you for going through this thing so late, very much. We know what it's
like. Thank you all for putting up with us.
Thank you, buddy. Okay, we're going to do this again. I guess you've been through this before in short takes. You know, they're NASA, EBU filming here, NASA headquarters filming here, and me taping for VOA, and a few still photographers around for a while. And seems a long way through this thing here, so hope we make it. First thing I wanted to get you to do was just to say for us, clean, and you looking right at me, say, I am Edwin, since Mike said Michael, do you mind using Edwin?
It's all right.
Would you prefer Buzz or Edwin? What we're looking
That's
for
all right.
is, I'm Edwin Aldrin, Lunar Module Pilot, Apollo 11, just in the clear. Whenever, okay.
I'm Edwin E. Aldrin, Jr., Lunar Module Pilot on the mission Apollo 11.
Fine. We're going to clip all these together with 1, 2, 3 with all of you and use them in different ways. Thank you much. Now, could you give me about any way that you want to phrase it and put it together, about 30 seconds or so, of your view of the overall mission purpose, and you go when you want to. Just say, Apollo 11 is, or something like that, and then go.
Apollo 11 has very simply been given the mission of carrying men to the moon, landing them there, and bringing them safely back. And this is the way we would like to view this. What additional information we are able to bring back, we will do to the utmost of our ability in carrying out that primary objective of landing and returning safely.
Fine, fine. That's nice and clean and clear. And you ran 28 seconds, 28 and a half. You got a good clock. What is this? Okay. And I will do little segments with you, and then I'll do a thank you, Buzz Aldrin, or something, sign-offs, little sign-offs at the end of each one of them. Buzz, what most attracted you to joining the space agency and becoming an astronaut?
The challenge of the, perhaps as you might call it, the epitome of flying experiences and flying challenges, I think is what attracted me. It looked to me at the time as though this was the natural extension of all the talents that I seem to have acquired. Both in a flying, manually controlling vehicles and understanding how they were put together, and also in the educational experiences that I've had. Adding these all together seemed to me to qualify me for this particular job, and it was a challenge, and I accepted that challenge and applied for the astronaut business.
Have you always felt that flying and this extension of flying space would be a part of your career?
No, I certainly didn't. I was just like all the rest of us until the Mercury program actually started moving. Having man in outer space was not one of the things that I had anticipated. Certainly within in the time frame that we've seen it come about.
What is your background in flying? And if we may go back just a step or two beyond that, tell us about how you got interested in moving into aviation. Where were you born, for instance?
I was born in Montclair, New Jersey. My father has had considerable aviation experience, and I think...
Your father was in the service, wasn't he?
My father was in the service. He's a retired Air Force colonel now. I think primarily his association with the early days in aviation had a considerable effect on my desire to enter into the flying business. I had flown with him several times.
You grew up around airplanes then?
That's right, yes.
Even as a child?
He was manager of Newark Airport for a while in my early years, and I would take several flights with him from Newark Airport.
And then you went to West Point, didn't you?
That's right. Leaving high school in Montclair, New Jersey, I went to West Point with the idea of joining the Air Force upon graduation. And there I entered flying training with the Air Force in 1951. In 1952, following jet pilot training, I was received orders to Korea, and I flew a combat tour over there in F-86 fighter jets.
That's about the hottest plane there was back then, wasn't it?
That was the goal of just about every pilot that was in the fighter business, to fly the Sabre jet, just as I'm sure the Apollo spacecraft is the aim of space-oriented people today.
What seems the epitome of performance and technique in one year changes in the next, doesn't it?
Well, we have many hot fighter aircraft that I would like to fly these days.
You still would like to fly,
yes,
some of them?
Certainly.
Thank you very much, Buzz Aldrin. Did that cover that adequately for you, that question on the influence? Okay. This is for Sweden. Sweden was wondering about... You want to ask it again? All right, just a little addendum on the influence your father. I'll rephrase the question. This is for Sweden, asking the question. Your father was an aviator. How would you say he has influenced you over the years as to your profession and your outlook and how you approach it?
I think his advice has benefited me considerably in many of the major decisions that I've made along my career. He influenced my decision to attend West Point. Certainly to enter into the Air Force and make flying my career was influenced by his association with aviation. To return from Europe and pursue further education at Massachusetts Institute of Technology was considerably influenced by the fact that many years earlier, he had attended MIT and also received his doctor's degree at that place. I frequently asked him for advice. I asked him what he thought about entering the space program, and he thought that that was a noble thing to do. He was a little reluctant to encourage me because I think at the time he didn't think my chances were very good to be accepted.
Fine. That's very nice and clear there. Took all of 1 minute and 5 seconds. Okay. I want to go a little later. I want to go to your research there at MIT, but the most important thing, we wanted some little clips. Obviously, we're all trying to gather short clips to drop in at various phases of our broadcasting during the mission. So we want to use this next piece in real time with you, but we want a good clear tape of you saying it. Would you describe, I'll tell you what I'm going to ask, then I'll ask the question clean. Just the final phases, let's say go from high gain. We'll already be discussing what high gain, low gain, and so forth are, but describe the action of the lunar module and your part in it from, say, about high gain on to touchdown. And do it in the present tense, we are, or something, as though you're there going through the thing for him, and then we'll be using this when it happens. Buzz, during the final phases of the lunar landing, you're quite busy, as is Neil. Would you describe what's happening during that final approach and landing phase of the mission.
We've now passed the point where any subsequent decision not to continue landing would commit us to making use of the ASCEND engine and to staging. So at this point, we're very interested in the status of the various systems that would be called on and used in the event we were to run into any difficulty. As we are now proceeding lower in the vicinity of 5,000-6,000 feet, we now are pitching over to the point where we can pick up the visibility, the first visibility of the potential landing site. The computer is displaying to us now our depression angle, so that through the landing point designator, by looking along this depression angle, we can see exactly where the computer thinks the landing site will be. The computer is also displaying to us our altitude rate in feet per second and our altitude in feet above the ground. On the alternate guidance system, or the abort guidance system, we also have the capability of calling up these same pieces of information to confirm that both guidance systems are performing satisfactorily. We have also displays now of the radar, the landing radar information that is being incorporated into the guidance system. As we approach closer down in the vicinity of 2,000 feet, it is my task to update the altitude that is in the abort guidance system to be more correctly in agreement with what the primary guidance system has. The primary purpose of this is to afford it a more accurate set of initial conditions if it were required to be used to put us back into orbit immediately.
How late can you get down close to the surface and still stage abort?
We essentially have the capability of aborting at any point in the descent. The initial action that would be taken with during any decision not to land would be an immediate throttle up of the descent engine and notifying the computer that we elect to proceed in an abort mode. This immediate throttle up would arrest any rate of descent that we have. We would then make a decision as to which guidance system we wish to continue with.
The pings or the ags?
Pings or ags, that's right. That's the first decision we actually make when we reach an abort. Which system will we use? Now, since we've throttled up, the fuel consumption on the descent engine is going to increase considerably. So we'll be very closely monitoring the fuel quantity as displayed to us on two redundant percentage display meters. And when this fuel quantity approaches about 2%, we would then select the ASCEND engine by means of the abort stage switch, which essentially discontinues thrust on the descent engine, stages the vehicle, drops away the descent stage, and fires the ASCEND engine in several tenths of seconds.
Several tenths of a second? That was my next question. How fast could you actually go to this abort mode, should you need to?
Essentially, instantaneously. Now, the ASCEND engine does have lower acceleration than full thrust with an empty descent stage. So the ability to arrest a rate of descent is greater with 100% descent engine throttle setting than with the abort stage. There is a region in the descent where, depending upon the delay that would take place if the descent engine were to just all of a sudden stop, there is a region that people have chosen to call the dead man's curve, which occurs very closely in the vicinity of 100 to 125 feet, where if we were to wait this full 4 seconds, we would not be able to successfully abort. But if some problem were to develop at that point in the mission, I feel quite confident that we can beat 4 seconds at least by a factor of four.
And then a nominal touchdown would progress how?
Well, this would probably proceed in a sequence where at about 2,000 to 1,000 feet, we would make a final decision as to any redesignation that might be made. And a redesignation is a method of signaling the primary guidance computer that you wish to wish it to select an alternate landing place, either to the left or to the right, or downrange or back closer to us. And we do this by making appropriate signals through the hand controller. But when we get to a point around 1,000 feet, the capability of getting much for this is pretty well diminished. As we pass this point, we have already verified the control, the manual control, by means of, at higher altitudes, putting the guidance switch from automatic to attitude hold and manually flying it to zero out the attitude error needles. We then give it back to the automatic system because it does a very fine job of flying. And the reason we take over is just to assess the manual capability. This option would probably be used then for any last-second changes, which, judging by the areas that we're going into, I think the chances is fairly high that we will elect to use this manual option of redirecting in terms of 50, maybe 100 feet laterally to one side, or maybe extending our range some to avoid crater, some irregularity in the surface, or
a
maybe just
rock.
To select a smoother area in comparison to the relative terrain.
Thanks very much, Buzz Aldrin, for describing this descent and touchdown. You want to wipe off?
I wasn't finished.
Okay. Let's back up. Whoa. All right, we'll tighten them together. Continue as though you were. Forget I interrupted you.
Now, having taken over manually the control of the vehicle, we'd also want to make adjustments in the rate of descent, and we can do this by means of a rate of descent switch. And as soon as we start to throw this little toggle switch, either up or down, the computer immediately says, all right, you want to control vertical velocity from this point on. I will give you the vertical velocity that you have right now or change it by 1 foot per second for each switch actuation. And this appears to give us extremely good control over the final phase of descent. It's called a semi-automatic throttle. Actually, the computer controls the throttle, but we tell it what we want.
Now?
And this, we hope, will give us our best chance for a successful landing.
Well, thank you very much, Buzz Aldrin, for describing that descent and touchdown. You want to wipe off a little here? You got a hanky? We can break a sec here. That was pretty warm in there. Is it pretty hot in there?
Yeah,
it's a lot hotter now.
We've traded the heat somehow through some mechanism.
Go across right here, too. Yeah.
Last several times I was in here, it seemed the person on the other side was suffering more than I was.
Okay. This is the sins of living. Okay, let's see. Final phase of landing. Okay, now, lunar surface activity, the same sort of thing. If we can, that we will try to use in real time, and do it a little tighter and a little more synoptically, if you can, mm-hmm. on this one. Just survey through the 2 hours, and if you will, just zip through the main experiments and the sample collection. Just
do you want me to preview this with how we get there from touchdown?
Well, no, we'll assume you're already there, and then
yeah.
We've already progressed with you to the point of touchdown.
Yeah. But I mean, from that point on.
Yeah, from that point on, right.
Immediately after...
I'll just phrase the question to you, and then you go. Buzz, would you summarize the activities which you and Neil will pursue on the surface of the moon?
One of the first things that we will be engaged in is making immediate decisions as to how long we'll be staying on the surface. There are several favored abort points that we will be checking various systems to get a stay or no stay beyond these points. The first one occurs some 4 or 5 minutes after touchdown, the next one about 10 minutes, and the final stay occurs one revolution afterward. What we will be doing during that first revolution is very intensely preparing the vehicle for a simulated countdown to launch, which we will carry up to the last 5 or 10 minutes before the ascent, one revolution later, as the command module comes over. Following this period, we'll go through a power down of the systems in the lunar module, preparing it for an extended stay on the surface. We will have an eat period followed by about a 4-hour rest period. When we awake, hopefully from much needed sleep of 4 hours, we'll have another eat period and go through about a 2-hour plus EVA preparation period.
Do you think you'll really be able to sleep at that point?
I don't think we'll be able to answer that until we get there and give it a try. We'll certainly need that rest period, and we'll do everything that we can to do to gain the most benefit out of that 4-hour time period.
And then what happens?
Following the EVA preparation period, we will go through the planned 2-man excursion on the surface, with Neil exiting the spacecraft first. As he goes down the ladder, I'll be taking pictures of him with a 16-millimeter camera through the window. Television camera will also be recording his activities. Initially, he'll collect a contingency sample. As I descend onto the surface, he will then be collecting a bulk sample of a larger sample of the lunar material. While he's doing this, I'll be participating in an extended EVA evaluation, just what are the capabilities of man to perform tasks on the lunar surface. We'll then join together following the deployment of television and perhaps the deployment of the flag on the surface. We'll then perform jointly an inspection, walking around the lunar module, looking at the various systems, the landing gear, making a very thorough inspection of everything that we can observe on it. In the process of doing this, we'll be taking a series of panorama photographs at 3 different locations as we move around. When we get to the about 3/4 of the way around the LEM, we'll begin to deploy several experiments. One is a laser retro reflector, and we'll offload these two from the scientific equipment bay. The other experiment is a passive seismometer. The deployment of these experiments will take some 5 to 10 minutes, and they're to be deployed some 50 to 60 feet away from the lunar module. We return from this excursion around the lunar module. We'll then pick up the equipment for a documented sample in detail in a predetermined location some 40, 50, 60 feet away from the lunar module. Following this, we'll package up this these samples, conduct a few core tube samples and other brief experiments, pick up the solar wind experiment, and then prepare these packages to be transported up into the lunar module. I'll enter into the LEM first, and then Neil will convey these two sample return containers up on this tether assembly. Once they're inside, then he'll re-enter the lunar module, and we'll pressurize, and that'll be the end of our EVA.
Thanks very much, Buzz Aldrin. Boy, time's running out. John, how much? How are we doing? I got 2.5 here, according to my time. Huh? They're blowing a whistle. Buzz, your early research on orbital mechanics of rendezvous has certainly had an impact on the program. How have you felt its contribution from your position here at the Manned Spacecraft Center since you've been an astronaut, your doctor's dissertation?
Well, I think that many other people were thinking along these same lines, and it gave me the ability to and equipped me in a way to be able to talk to these people and convey to them just how a pilot feels about performing some of these orbital mechanics maneuvers. In the process of this association, we've been able to refine many of the maneuver techniques to a point where I feel confident that even though there are many ways of carrying out rendezvous operations, I feel we have a very sound plan that is quite flexible and able to handle the many and various conditions that could be required in abort conditions and in normal conditions for the conducting the rendezvous following an ascent from the lunar surface.
From what you know of the conditions of the moon, how low do you think a command module could safely go if it had to effect a rather risky rescue?
Oh, I think it could go to somewhere in the neighborhood of 50, 60,000 feet. I don't think that low an altitude is required for any recovery that I would anticipate.
Buzz, good luck throughout the flight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, John?
You're the worst defender of them all. You make Berkman look like a saint.
Give him hell.
Yeah.
Give him hell. See you when you get back.
Get out of the hot sun.